LaunchDarkly enables development and operations teams to deploy code at any time, even if a feature isn't ready to be released to users. Wrapping code with feature flags gives you the safety to test new features and infrastructure in your production environments without impacting the wrong end users. Learn more at LaunchDarkly.com.
Hello and welcome to the InfoQ podcast. I'm Daniel Bryant, News Manager here at InfoQ and Product Architect at Datawire. And I recently had the pleasure of sitting down with Johnny Borsico, a Site Reliability Engineer at Heroku. I recently bumped into Johnny's work when I was trying to learn more about the Go language in the context of serverless applications. I was keen to understand how language choice affected both the design of the architecture of the application and also the operational characteristics of the app too. Johnny very kindly agreed to share his knowledge with me here, as he's been writing and teaching about these topics both in person and via his O'Reilly online courses for a number of years now. I was also keen to pick Johnny's brains in relation to his role at Heroku as an SRE. In my limited experience with the role of SRE, I've seen it implemented in very different ways across practically every organization. I've also seen folks simply try and copy what is described in the Google SRE books with decidedly mixed success. I was keen to explore Johnny's experience here and learn from his successes and his experiences. Hello, Johnny, and welcome to the InfoQ podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So could you briefly introduce yourself, please, and share a bit about your background or a recent career highlight, please?
Yeah, sure thing. Borsico is the last name. Folks usually wonder, how do you spell the last name? So let's get that out of the way right now. So currently, I am an SRE for Heroku, which is owned by Salesforce. That acquisition happened a long time ago. It's interesting to still find out that people don't know that. Heroku is a Salesforce organization. So that has presented its own sort of a set of challenges as well when you're working within a team, within a broader organization. But as an SRE, I found that role has really sort of taken advantage of my ability to be a diplomat in some ways, something that I think has always been an interesting aspect of sort of how I deal with systems and people and engineering. The people aspect of things has always been something that's interesting to me, and I've sort of developed that over the years. But my career spans everything from CTO to project manager to obviously the ops work I'm doing now, and now the SRE stuff. It's been a front-end developer. I've even done design in the very beginning. I've had almost 23 years now in the industry to sort of try a bunch of different things. And yeah, because of that, I think that's really where the people aspect of things comes from, right? Regardless of the role, you know, you always have to deal with people. And I've taken that to heart and sort of really tried to pay attention to that aspect of my career development.
Nice. We always say the technology is the easy part, right?
Exactly.
The people are the hard part.
Yeah, it really is.
Nice. So I actually bumped into your profile, I think from Brian Lyle's tweeting. I was looking for someone to chat about Go, about serverless, about SRE, and you tick all the boxes there, which is perfect. So diving in sort of one of the topics there, I saw you publish some stuff with O'Reilly around Go and serverless. Go as in the language and serverless. Could you give us a bit of background on what kind of use cases you were looking at solving with those technologies?
So it's interesting. So the two things, the serverless and Go, it was one of those things because I was sort of interested in both of them and passionate about both of them. I sort of put them together and sort of I've created courses around them. And with regards to O'Reilly, I'll be teaching serverless Go and also Go on its own as well with O'Reilly in the coming weeks. So the love affair really started with Go a few years ago. I attended the very first GopherCon back in 2014. My interest basically started developing right around late 2012, 2013, and sort of, you know, keeping an eye on the language. You know, as a technologist, you're always keeping your ear to the ground as to, okay, what's the next thing, right, that I should be paying attention to, right? Because nobody wants to sort of go obsolete, right? But in 2014, I went to the conference, a friend of mine, we flew from Boston, we went to Denver, I think that was the location. Yeah, I was sitting in the audience and watching the speakers and the topics and the performance characteristics of Go and the language, the syntax, and everything just started to click for me. I was like, okay, this might be it, right? I've never felt sort of this sort of enthusiastic about a language, about a technology before. And I just pursued that and really invested a ton of time into trying to learn it and made some mistakes early on and trying to overuse some of the features and stuff like that. So it's been like a really fun journey. And years later, I'm still very much involved in the Go community. And that takes shape in the form of a teaching. It takes shape in the form of running user groups. I currently co-run the Baltimore Go user group. And I've held workshops for GoBridge, which is an organization that cares about sort of diversity and inclusion within tech, specifically within the Go community. And I just enjoy teaching. I do corporate trainings every now and then, and I've done video courses, and I'm doing the live variety training coming up. So I enjoy being around the people in this community, and I enjoy teaching the technology. I enjoy building things with it. I don't know, it's been sort of a bet that I placed on the technology that has really been worthwhile considerably. The serverless stuff comes in really a few years ago as serverless started becoming the thing, right? That seems to be the next big thing. And in some ways, you know, it's a part of modern infrastructure, modern architecture for systems. There's this tendency for our industry to overhype on certain things, right? Like we even have memes about it, you know, there's this hype cycle and all that stuff. I think the serverless has its place definitely within an infrastructure. And as your business grows, as your sort of a team grows, as your needs grow, there's room for that technology as well. So a lot of my work in my career has been building sort of long-lived services and that kind of thing. So when microservices was all the rage, in some cases, in some corners, it still is. And then serverless came in. I'm like, okay, are we doing like nano services? Like, what is this thing? Like, where do I fit it into this whole thing? And in the end, you figured out, okay, well, no business that has been around long enough is going to be all in on one thing, right? It's always a mix, right? Unless you're like, you know, I have a startup that started yesterday. You don't have a completely homogeneous sort of a stack, right? It's not all serverless. I mean, some companies do strive for that, and some companies are doing that, and, you know, perhaps quite well. But again, over time, especially as new technologies come and go, there's no one tech to rule them all. It's always going to be constraint-based, the decisions that you're making. Where does this fit in? Would this technology or this paradigm apply better here than this other one? So I've kind of married the two things, my love for Go, and my seeking to understand serverless and where it fits into these sort of these trainings and this examination really of how well can I apply sort of the Go language? How well does it work within this world of serverless?
Perfect. I'd love to come back to some of the teaching stuff there, because as you and I were saying off mic at the beginning, that is super important and it's super hard to get right sometimes. But I wanted to dive in something you just said at the end there. What makes Go good for serverless apps?
So if you Google around, you'll find all kinds of different answers. Everybody has opinions, and us techies, you know, we have opinions for days on these things. Personally, I found that the speedy startup for Go was a key factor, right? Being able to have a statically binary where I have no dependencies around anything else other than basically say, hey, run this thing when this container fires up. It was really perfect. It was like, okay, well, I can build my Go programs the same way I traditionally would, right? Even if I had a sort of a long-lived service, I can build that, package it up, and have a cloud platform sort of a vendor run it for me. So for me, I didn't have to change the way I was doing Go programming, right? So when I write my Go code, there are certain idioms, there are certain practices that you follow, and those that are sort of commonly known, as you'll hear people talk about idiomatic Go within the Go community, that carries a certain weight and that means certain things. And, you know, I follow some of those practices for the most part as well. But the biggest thing for me is that, okay, I didn't have to change the way I was doing Go. Some of the same practices that I'd learned over the years, they still applied, right? So I was like, okay, what's changed is how long the application is going to be running for, right? That's really what's changed. And of course, that's going to affect your design. That's going to affect what you rely on within the environment, right? You have to expect that, okay, you're going to be launched. You're going to do some work. And then you can't assume you can hang on to state. You can't assume you can hang on to certain things, right? Certain network connections. You have to build a more resilient application. Your code has to be a lot more resilient, right? So those constraints, you do factor them in. And to some degree, they matter as well for long-lived services. But that was really the big draw for me. It was like, I don't have to change the way I do Go code, right, to take advantage of the serverless aspects of how it's deployed and how it's run.
I definitely learned some lessons the hard way when I started going Java and serverless. What was your like number one pain point or learning thing when you moved into serverless?
Go is well known for its concurrency primitives. And one of the hard lessons that I learned was that if all you do is consume the marketing, right, from all the different cloud providers that are saying, hey, serverless, right, you can do all these things, you know, whatever it is. And the code samples look so simple and they're so neat, right? They're well prepared, well presented, right? They make it seem like it's the easiest thing to just, you know, do, just drop your code and, you know, zip it up and put it in a bucket. We'll take care of all the things, right? And it's like, we'll take up the concurrency, as many of these things that you want. We'll auto-scale them up. We'll auto-scale them down. Don't worry at all about the scaling aspects of your code, right? So basically, I'd be writing my code, not really taking advantage of the concurrency primitives, you know, within the features within the Go language, right? And basically saying, you know, yeah, like every time, you know, a request comes in, for example, I have this thing here that's going to invoke my function and it's going to do that work. And then when it's done, it's going to shut down and that's it, right? And if you have, you know, say a million of these requests come in and you know, the infrastructure provider is going to spin these things up, a million of them, and do the work, right? And then you don't realize that, okay, it doesn't have to be a one-to-one sort of thing. Like one invocation of your request, you know, that spins up your application and does work. Like depending on the kind of problem you're solving, you can still take advantage of the concurrency primitives of your application. So typically you have, in the case of AWS, Lambda, you have about 15 minutes to get some piece of work done. So if I can, if the workload is such that I can spin up, in the case of Go, a bunch of Go routines to do work concurrently, ideally in parallel, I can take advantage of everything that the language has to offer, right? Within that one invocation of the program. I don't need to rely on the fact that, okay, every time a request comes in, I'm going to spin up this thing, wait for the boot time to do the work, and then expect that, okay, I can't process anything else until the next invocation comes in. We can do a lot of work within that 15 minutes, just, again, taking advantage of the features of the language itself. So I've had some interesting problems that I've had to sort of reapproach and redesign in that way, and basically saying, hey, you know what? Take advantage of the features of the cloud provider, right? In terms of the auto scaling and the concurrency that they promise, right? But don't forget that the language you're using, the technology you're using, right, also has capabilities. Like those don't go away just because there's a new deployment mechanism or a new runtime. Take advantage of the language of the tool that you have to do the work that you need to do.
What's it like in regards to the tool chain? Are you using the same IDE? Are you building things the same way, like using pipelines? Or how did that differ?
I like to think of this whole serverless ecosystem as going through sort of several phases. In the beginning, right, it was incredibly hard to be confident that the stuff you were writing locally would work well in the cloud environment without actually putting it in the cloud environment. Right. That story has gotten better over time as the providers have created sort of a local environments that you can test things in. Again, to use AWS, you can have a local DynamoDB if you want. You can have a local Lambda runtime if you want. You can have a mock API gateway if you want. So all the things that are typically part of the demos and the pieces of the technology, the platform that they like to sort of put together, right, to present sort of a unified solution, right, for serverless technologies. So they've created locally runnable versions of these things that simulate what the cloud environment is going to look like, right? But at the end of the day, you still need integration testing. At the end of the day, you still need to sort of ensure that things are going to work together, right? Sometimes you can't mock, right, a service you don't own. You can only go so far with that tool set. But the story for serverless development without having to put things in the cloud to test them and to make sure they work, that story has gotten better. And I think it will continue to get better over time as the developer experience becomes a priority on the feature roadmap for these providers. That's going to get better. And obviously, the community as well is sort of pitching in with various projects to sort of help mitigate the lack of good tools in that area. But again, you know, because developers, the mindshare, all the cloud providers want a good experience for developers. And at the end of the day, whoever's got the best experience, right, for developer mindshare, chances are they're going to also get more market share, right? So that whole experience is getting better. But again, you still need, in my opinion, you still need a staging environment. If you can, and you have the discipline and you have the right infrastructure for it, you should be testing in production as well. So the tool chain itself, the stuff you're doing locally, yes, you're going to write your unit tests. Yes, you're going to do a lot of things that you need to do, right? Regardless of the sort of deployment mechanism, but that's getting better. But that doesn't exclude the need for actually doing that integration testing with all the other bits, right? Like on the actual provider.
That makes total sense. It's something I bump into quite a lot at the moment, as in that need for that local dev experience. I do a lot of stuff in Kubernetes. We talk about this quite a lot. And the testing in production, like the joke is everyone tests in production, whether you know it or not, right? But as in, it's really key, particularly with like things like functions as a service or functions, you can spin them up and then route traffic accordingly. So what's your experience been like around the story of, say, Canary releasing or Dark launching, all these kind of cool things you do, where you're controlling at the edge what service, what function you may hit? Is that currently a good story or not in your experience?
It's absolutely possible. It's doable, but it is not simple. It's complicated. So when I think back of the promise of serverless, the marketing, I always sort of give the marketing a hard time because they make these things seem so simple. And in reality, it's far from. You need operations. You need somebody who's on your team who's operationally minded. You need infrastructure configuration. You need somebody to worry about the operability of whatever it is that you're going to put out there. and you need somebody who understands what it means to have a canary release, what it means to do some traffic shifting. You need somebody with that mindset, right? This whole serverless marketing makes it seem like, okay, all you need, dear developer building features, is to just, you know, don't worry about the orchestration bits, don't worry about the operational bits, right? Just write your features, put it out there, and let the cloud provider just figure all that out for you, right? It's zero touch ops, right? It's no ops. And I hear that, I'm like, that is a pile of, you know, yeah, let's keep it clean here. But it's the fallacy to think that just because you're drinking the Kool-Aid from these providers that somehow you don't have to have that conversation, right? Around, okay, I built this thing. It's a nano-service architecture, microservice, you know, Lambda serverless, whatever, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, having that conversation around operations, if you're waiting till the very end to figure out, okay, well, we built it, how do we now run it and operate it, right? Like, if you wait till like till the last minute to actually have that conversation, you're doing yourself a disservice.
I hear you, totally. And I was going to draw on your SRE experience here a little bit. What's the story like at the moment around observability or monitoring, logging? Because again, you've alluded to several times, Johnny, that we're building distributed systems, definitely with functions. So when a request comes in, it can often, you know, pinball all around the place. How do we as engineers debug when something's going wrong?
So whether it be serverless or microservice, in this world, once you start playing in this sandbox, tracing, I'd argue, is way more important than logging. That's been my experience. Because if you think about it, like, I miss the monolith days because you could have a request come in, right? You can see where, okay, the load balancer hands the request off to my application. And from top to bottom in one log file, you can kind of trace, you know, everything that the system did, right? Everything's being drained to the same log system. And you can kind of, you know, go into one dashboard and kind of see it. Maybe hopefully you can identify the particular request and kind of see everything nicely sort of linear within the application, right? In this world where you have bits and pieces sort of distributed and they all talking to each other behind the scenes, if you don't have tracing, you're in deep doo-doo. You need to somehow be able to sort of see where the handoffs are happening, who's receiving what requests and from what other part of the system, and how long they're spending, what other systems are they interacting with. You need tracing. I have this joke with some of my peers. I'm like, okay, I'm not a logger, I just trace a lot. Right? And then for those who know the hip-hop song, that they'll sort of kind of pick up on the reference there, right? So it's way easier for me to find out what's going on when a problem happens to basically pull up a tracing interface and see which part of the system dropped the ball or took the longest or whatever it is, right? The logging comes when you really know where to look, right? When you know where to look, right? Logging helps. When you don't know where to look, you're trying to figure out, okay, what was the last thing to touch this request, right? Without tracing, it's very, very hard to do. Otherwise, you're grepping your logs, and that is not a good look.
I never thought I'd get a big pun reference into the podcast. I love that. Well played, well played. Switching gears a little bit now, I wanted to dive into some of the SRE world, because definitely some folks around the world, SRE is still a bit of a buzzword. You know, it's dev, there's ops, there's DevOps, there's SRE now, site reliability, engineering. What does it look like at Heroku? What does SRE look like?
So let's set the scene a little bit here. Heroku's been around and doing its thing for a long while, right? For a long time. You have developers that rave about sort of the ease of building the applications. All they have to do is do a git push Heroku master and their application is running. They don't have to worry about operations. They don't have to worry about, you know, a lot of these things. You know, when they need to scale, they just increase their dyno counts. The add-on system is fantastic. And I'm not saying that because I work there, you know, I've been using Heroku way before I even worked there. And I've always sort of really liked what the platform has to offer, right? So that means that because Heroku has been around a long time, and it certainly predates the term, right? SRE certainly predates that terminology and those titles and everything else. That means that this team, right? And obviously has changed and morphed over time, has had to sort of know and understand what they were doing, right? Which is what obviously made Heroku popular and still is. They kind of had to sort of develop practices and understand sort of really how to put systems, distributed systems together that can sort of run at the scale Heroku runs at. So in a sense, some of the values, right? Some of the principles of SRE, they've already been practicing a lot of these things. They just didn't have the title, right, for these things, right? Certainly, SRE brings certain disciplines, right, really relying on SLIs and SLOs in order to set your SLAs with customers and everything else. So there's processes and procedures, and depending on what company you work at, you'll see various amounts of these practices within the organization. Oh, and by the way, as a side note, SRE looks different at every company. I've never seen a job change so drastically from company to company like any other job. I mean, we'll touch on that later. But at Heroku, it has become, so the SRE team that I'm a part of, really, we are almost like a team of diplomats, a team of production engineering, sort of a best practices, operational excellence kind of team, whereby, you know, we identify components within the system that need a little more TLC, that need a little more attention from an operations standpoint. And we work with those teams to basically, hey, let's go through the process. Let's go through our production readiness process and figure out, okay, what do you have right now? What do you not currently have? Where are your pain points? So it's more of a conversation, right? Is how can we serve you, this team, the owner of this component or this set of components? Like, how can we make your life easier? How can we reduce toil? How can you make it so that when we have an incident, we can solve the problem a lot more quickly? How can we reduce the MTTR here? So it's really that kind of conversation where we're really there to serve. We can't go in with a tome, right? The guidelines, the mandate, right? Come into a team and slap it in some sort of metaphorical desk and says, hey, you need to go through these checkpoints. Nobody likes that, right? Even if you could do that, like, nobody likes to come in and being told what to do, especially within an organization like Heroku, where people have been operating like really large scale systems for so long. You can't come and say, hey, we just picked up a book from the big G and now, you know, we've got processes. We want to change everything and we want to sort of enter. Like, no, we can't apply the blue book. We cannot just apply it just one-to-one. It just doesn't work like that. And like I said before, SRE looks different at every company. You have to pick the nuggets, the insights, what works best for this company. We're constantly studying and learning and saying, hey, this is working for this company or this team. How can we incorporate that into what we need to do, right? Make that part of our sort of our repertoire, our tool belt, right? To be able to say, hey, you know what? For you, we noticed that you're having problems with this particular aspect of this component. This is something that's working for this team. How about we work together to figure out whether that can work for you too, right? It's a way more diplomatic, way more sort of in service of than coming in and say, hey, this is how we do SRE. You're going to do it this way.
What's your experience with error budgets? Is it something you do at Heroku or not?
Let me set the stage here for how we treat error budgets. So when we were trying to introduce more SRE principles at Heroku, we had this ask that teams start to measure SLOs and sort of figure out, sort of identify really what their SLOs should look like and what are the SLIs that they need to sort of capture and what information they need to capture to be able to really have a meaningful and intelligent conversation around the systems. Again, know that because Heroku has been Heroku and operating at the scale it has successfully for many, many years, now, basically, it was a matter of, okay, can you prove that you're operating? We know you're operating, you have operational excellence. We know that you've been doing well for many, many years. Otherwise, you wouldn't still be in business, right? So we know you've been doing the right thing, for at least for the majority of your existence. We know you've been doing the right thing. Now, how can we identify the SLOs that we're already meeting, right? To serve, right? To basically say, hey, this is the baseline we know we're at right now. It's more like identifying the SLOs and saying, this is what we're meeting right now. So it's like measuring current state, right? Now, where the error budgets come in, obviously, you want to make sure that as teams push out new software, as the system changes, you want to make sure that, okay, when something happens, you're chipping away at your budget, right? That means, you know, you need to go back and basically look at the last release that caused an incident, perhaps, and say, okay, well, what do we need to do here? So it's more at this stage in our implementation of SRE, this is more of a, it's not the thing that prevents teams from releasing new software. Like, we're not coming at you with the error budget hammer and says, you exhausted your budget for this month or for this period. You can't release any more new software. Again, this is another example where, as prescribed by the book, right, we can't just take that and apply it like as a hard and fast rule and say, hey, no more releases this month. Like, we can't do that. It serves as informational, right? It helps us with sort of a knowing where to look, right? What do we pay attention to, right, right now? Because this system has caused, you know, a couple of outages this month. Let's pay some more attention to that, right? And we look at the error rates. We look at, you know, all the dashboard. I mean, we have dashboards galore. We have, you know, logs galore. I mean, we ingest a ton of logs, right? All these things help to inform, right, where to pay attention to, but we can't pick any one thing from any one feature from the books and say, hey, this is now a mandate. This is how we do business.
That seems like a very sensible approach. Something you mentioned is the sort of role of the diplomat. And I like that. I've not heard it said that way before, but I like that a lot. And how does that work? Is it sort of a push or a pull? Is it a case of you go out to the teams and say, hey, here's how I can help you? Or do you advertise what you're doing and wait for them to come to you? I'm guessing it's probably a hybrid between the two. But how does that work out?
It is a hybrid. And it's one of those things where, depending on a team, right? So some teams within Heroku, and I've seen this in other companies and other organizations as well, some teams, because of the nature of the kind of services and kind of components they're dealing with, maybe they're dealing with the cloud infrastructure directly. So they're the abstractions, right, between the developer who wants to just do a Git push Heroku master and the interaction with, you know, the cloud providers and the different instances and the compute engines and the database engines, all that stuff. So you have these teams that require a tremendous amount of discipline, right, to basically to provide that abstraction, right, between developers, right, the developer experience and all the bits and pieces, right, the sausage, right, behind the scenes, like how it's made, basically. They have to have that sort of that discipline. So for those teams, right, they might have specific pain points that they want you to address, but they're not going to say, hey, SRE, why don't you come in here and do a complete overhaul of everything we've been doing? That's not realistic. So they may come to us and says, hey, we're experiencing pager burden. The pager burden this month has been killer, right? We have these components here. They're the chronic cause of certain incidents and certain outages. We need a way, right? We're busy putting out fires over there, right? We need somebody to be worrying about the process improvements, sort of the things we need to do, right, to make sure that those hotspots, like we can address them, right? So they'll bring us in or they say, hey, like we need some help here because we just don't have the time. It's not our forte to be thinking about process and how to make this aspect of things easier to deal with because we're over there putting out some fires, right? So this is where we're sort of called in to sort of help provide sort of that guidance. Again, it's diplomacy because, again, you don't want to go in with a rule book and saying this is how you must do things. They've been operating at an excellent level for years, right? Every team has pain points. Every team has a service that's problematic. You know, the one service, you know, nobody wants to touch. You know, maybe it's written in a different language that, you know, like whoever wrote it has long left. I mean, every company has that one service, right? So the capability you provide is an outsider's view and saying, hey, given all the facts that you presented, given what we've been able to find out, we'll even have our team members on board into their different teams, be part of the development and release workflow. That way we get to absorb all of the pain, right? And then, and only then, we sit down, we have a conversation and say, hey, this is what you could do here, right? This is what you need to hook into that we already have that's going to alleviate some pain for you. And this is where you can improve. This is what we've noticed. Again, it's a relationship, right? Not some sort of going to come in and we're going to provide a mandate. Really, it is a relationship. And as we all know, hopefully we all know by now, a successful relationship is based on good communication. And if you don't have that, it all falls apart.
That's been a great tour of SRE, John. I really appreciate your insight there. It's some unique things, which I'll definitely ponder on a bit more. I want to take a step back now, because I think you're in a very unique place with your role at Heroku and your past experience, your love of serverless. What do you think about the current state of cloud platforms today? You know, I'm a big Kubernetes person, yeah, so I do a lot of Kubernetes stuff, but I'm totally conscious it's kind of the foundation. Like the amount of times I've gone to a company and they just want a Heroku-like experience there. They want to get pushed to Kubernetes. And I'm like, you know, that doesn't exist unless you buy something else or plug in something else. What's your opinion of the state of cloud platforms and where we're going?
So it's interesting because I've been around long enough to have seen various waves of the next big thing. I'm doing air quotes for an audio. Everybody thinks they need Kubernetes. And when I hear that, I'm like, really, really? Like, what makes you think? And as you say, they want that PaaS experience, right? They want that, yeah, I just want my developers to just easily just worry about the code, just push, you know, the bits somewhere, and then everything magically happens. And we think Kubernetes is the path to that promised land, right? And I'm like, okay, first of all, unless you are in the business of providing PaaS, unless that is your business, right, you want to think carefully around taking on the operational burden of something like Kubernetes and bringing it into your team. Because guess what? If you didn't have a dedicated headcount for this, or at least a couple, depending on the size of your team, depending on the size of your needs, yeah, you can download the bits of a GitHub and whatnot, but you now need headcount. You need people, right, to understand this thing, operate this thing. Kubernetes is evolving every day. Vendors are now producing things, you know, to that plug in and work with Kubernetes. I mean, you know, now you need people to understand, okay, what's a service mesh? You know, how do I get my systems to talk to each other? Like, I need to do sidecars. Now I'm doing this, I'm doing that. Like, I need to understand the Kubernetes API. Like, you are introducing a whole host of new challenges into your world. And that's even before you can get something standing for your developers to actually push code and actually the value actually trying to derive out of getting into such a sort of orchestration systems. Like, it's going to take you a while to get there, right? And again, everybody's going to be doing it a little differently because that's the way business is. No two businesses are exactly the same, at least not in my experience. So every business is going to have a different sort of constraints that require you to have a certain implementation, certain do Kubernetes a particular way that suits the business. So that's the thing folks don't understand. It's like, look, unless you are in the business of, say, a Heroku, right? Unless you are in the business of providing where this is all you do, or you are a large enough company, right, to take on this burden. So I mentioned before that Heroku is owned by Salesforce. So we have teams at Salesforce, right, whose entire job is to worry about Kubernetes. Naturally, as you might expect, right? We have the person power, we have the budget, we have the people and the teams dedicated towards, you know, creating that world for developers who don't need to worry about operations, for them to just do their job and put their stuff out there. So the hype, again, it gets people, no matter how many times that we experience a hype cycle with every new piece of technology that's supposed to be the new silver bullet that solves everything. We go through this process where we do some thinking, right? We think back like, maybe we were too hasty about, you know, certain things, right? And again, I'm not throwing shade at Kubernetes at all. I'm just saying that if you are looking at Kubernetes as a solution to your sort of operations problem, unless you spend some time really digging into what kind of problem you need to solve, first of all, right? Understanding what your problem actually is. If you can get away with running your stuff on a Heroku or, you know, interacting directly with an AWS or GCP or Azure or whatever, even before Kubernetes was around, that these vendors are already providing best practices. And this is how you architect systems. Anybody who's been in the AWS world for a while, they'll be very familiar with the well-architected framework. There's all these best practices out there for how to run, and they have products that abstract away the instance management, all that. I mean, there's the whole serverless thing with lambdas and event bridges and how all these things sort of work together. Those vendors are already providing abstractions on top of the raw compute stuff already. It might be that you just need an application that is built on those raw primitives, right? Or following the best practices of those vendors, right? And then the other thing is like, hey, Kubernetes, because I want to be able to run Azure, AWS, and GCP. Okay. I'm like, okay, if that is indeed part of your business model, if that is indeed what you want to be able to do so that you're not locked in, right, into any one vendor, if that is indeed a business priority for you, great. For a lot of folks, it's just, okay, like the cost of having that abstraction that can run on top of all the different vendors, and every vendor has something a little different. So you can't just drop it and then, you know, it all works, right? If you're going to be rerunning Kubernetes within AWS, you still have to have some concerns and constraints that you're not going to have in GCP. Same thing for Azure. So everything requires a bit of tweaking and management. Again, somebody somewhere on your team and your organization needs to worry about these bits and pieces, this configuration, right? So again, it's all about what is the business trying to get done, right? We hire to solve business problems, not to play around with tech, not to play around with, you know, YAML files all day long, right? That's not why we hire. That's not why we're there. We're here to provide value, right? So understand what kind of business problem you're trying to solve.
To have a platform, you need a bunch of tooling. And one anti-pattern I see a lot with engineers, and I'm sure I've done it myself, to be completely honest, is discounting our time. Yeah, we forget. It's the classic kind of hack and use. Oh, I could build that in a weekend. And like, maybe you could. Can you scale it? Can you run it? Can you look after it? Have you got any advice for perhaps junior engineers, or to be honest, even me, even the old school folks, on how to overcome that bias to discount our time and think about, you know, we could just pay some money and get a tool to do this, for example?
So the quickest thing sort of junior engineers realize in my experience is that, okay, so you want to build something on a weekend, right? Let's take Facebook or Twitter. Yeah, that's just like a stream, you know, as you scroll down, you know, you just do a Ajax call. I might be dating myself. I'm not sure we call it Ajax anymore, but you know, you do some call in the background and then you update the DOM and, you know, you just keep these things coming in. And okay, like, yeah, it might make for a nice toy, you know, like a nice learning experience. And we haven't even started talking about what it means to actually have a product, right? That's a whole different conversation, right? So we tend to think that it's just about technology. I'm just going to figure out what is the right amount of JavaScript and React or Vue, whatever it is, to sprinkle on this thing to have like a functional sort of a MVP, as it were, right? And we realize, okay, just for the technology alone, building the features, honestly, that is the easy part. That is the stuff where you don't have to worry about scale for things. It's just you on your local host, just, you know, hacking away at something, you know, you clicking, everything's working just fine. Your database requests are quick, you know, because you've got a local MySQL or Postgres or whatever it is running. Like, everything is just smooth like butter, you know. And then say you go to the next stage, you want to deploy, you want to put it on a cloud vendor, be it Heroku or AWS or whatever, you want to put it out there. And say you start getting a little bit of success, and maybe, you know, you find find your way on the front page of Hacker News, and now you start getting traffic, right? And then you realize, oh crap, right? The database queries are not as quick anymore, being the more requests you start receiving. Like, okay, I need to do some scaling here, right? Do I do like horizontal scaling or vertical scaling? What is even the horizontal or vertical scaling? Now you have to worry about these things that perhaps as a developer, especially as a junior, and I've not been there, I definitely thought, hey, yeah, I can do that in the weekend, right? And you realize, okay, there is so much more to actually having something that can work for people, not just you, right? That can work for people. The more popular whatever your thing is, right, the more you have to spend on the operability, right, of whatever that thing is, right? That's just the technology part. And then now you say, okay, well, yeah, I can build a Twitter in a weekend. Okay, what about the actual products out of things? Do you know how to market? Do you know how to advertise? Are you tracking your UX? And there's all these other things, right? There's the selling, right? Like, I don't know about you, but I'm perhaps horrible at sales. You know, I'm a technologist at heart. I get on a sales call, you know, and I'm biting my tongue not to start jumping in with like all kinds of technical jargon, right?
Yeah, solutions.
Yeah, I'm an engineer. Like, I'm here to solve problems, y'all. Like, what is this stuff you're talking about here? Like, marketing and sales and all these things. I had to learn over the years that, okay, you have to learn to communicate at the right level. You have to educate yourself around all the different bits and pieces that go into really sort of taking something from just an idea that I'm hacking around on my laptop to an actual business, an actual product, right? So again, I have the benefit of time. So I have seen these things. I've been part of startups several now where I've seen this whole thing sort of play out and I have an appreciation for it. But if you're a junior engineer and you don't have the benefit of that experience, read, consume, you know, hit up, you know, people and say, hey, I noticed you've been at this for a while. I'd like some advice. And most of the time, people will respond in kind and be like, yeah, yeah, sure. I don't mind having a 30-minute Zoom with you and talking about some stuff. I do that now. Now people reach out to me and I usually make myself available to do that as a way of giving back in some way. So it's not just about technology. And that's something that I had to learn many, many years ago. The technology is the easy part. It's the people. It's all the things, all the bits and pieces that come after.
Superb, Johnny. And that nicely leads into my final question here as we wrap up. I'm definitely a big fan of learning, love what you're doing on the O'Reilly platform. If folks are looking to follow in your footsteps, could you give a few words of wisdom as to how to get started with learning, how to teach even?
I have this saying that has helped me ground myself in a lot of different contexts. And that saying is, ego is the enemy, right? I found out that my ego, right, years ago, I found out that my ego prevented me from doing a lot of things. For example, say you're doing pairing with somebody. If you are in your head worrying about, okay, what is this person going to think about my code, my ability to code, right, how I reason about something, I'm not that smart, right? They're like godlike, right? Like, look how fast they're typing, right? Look how well they're able to reason about something, especially if you're pairing with a senior engineer or like an architect or something like that. And they seem like magical beings, right? That have all this knowledge, this esoteric sort of understanding of things. And you start going in your own head and thinking, oh man, like I can't hold a candle to this person, right? You start getting in your head and that detaches you from the experience you're supposed to be having right now, right? Which is, I'm pairing with somebody. They might be typing or I might be driving, right? We're trying to solve a problem, right? You don't realize that, okay, be in the moment, be in the experience that you're having, right? Don't be in your own head. You're trying to learn. In some cases, you're trying to teach, right? So remove yourself from the equation, right? The moment you remove yourself from the equation and you allow the experience to be what you're focused on, right? The ego takes a back seat. Now you're all about sort of learning from the experience, right? About the domain you're in and also about the actual experience of engaging in a pairing session or a code review session or, you know, an architecture meeting or whatever the case may be, right? So for teaching in particular, I had to remove myself from the equation there and thinking that, okay, I'm here standing in front of these people, you know, be it physically or virtually, right? They're here to get something, right, from me, right, to be able to do their jobs, right, well or better. A lot of times I'm introducing people to programming for the very first time, which is an incredible privilege, by the way, to teach people who have never programmed before how to do that. I mean, that is the honor of my life. Like, I've had the privilege of doing that a number of times now. And really, that these are the things I'm going to remember most when I go to my deathbed, right? Like, I'm going to be like, okay, I introduced people to programming for the first time and perhaps changed their lives and the lives of their families forever. To me, that there's no greater honor, right? So removing myself from, okay, I'm not here to show you how much I know. I'm not here to show off. I'm not here to razzle and dazzle you with terminology. And matter of fact, when I teach, I try to leave technical jargon, even if applicable. I try to leave as much of that stuff out of the way I teach as possible, especially to a beginner crowd. because you can easily lose them, right? Again, the ego. You go in your own head, start thinking, okay, how can I impress? How can I sound intelligent and smart and all these things? Again, you're making it about you. And it's never about, like, a safe bet, really, in most things in life, right? It's never about you. Okay. You remove yourself from the equation. I keep that in mind, whether I'm teaching, whether I'm pairing, whether somebody's asking me for advice. And even if you are in a position where you ought to feel like proud of yourself or whatnot, resist the temptation to make it about you. Because the moment you do that, it's no longer about them and what they're trying to get out of the conversation. The thing is too, the secret that I've learned over the years is that the more you give, right, to people, the more you're going to get back, right? Like, stop worrying about yourself so darn much, right? Like, give of your time. Like, right now, my time is the most precious thing I have, right? But I still choose to give some of it, right, to a certain degree. I'm realistic, right? There's only so much I can do, right? So I'll give some of my time to, say, a student too, or somebody who's about to go into the tech career and they don't know where to start, or somebody who's been in business for a while and they know I have a particular, you know, domain expertise in an area. They'll come and ask me for some insight. I'm willing to share that knowledge. And sometimes when I have questions, like, I don't know it all. It's foolish to think I know it all, right? So I'll go to the people I know could provide some insight and answer some questions, right? So when you give, right, it's easy for you to receive as well. I mean, I know it's cliche to say that, but really, I've gotten so much in return from my giving, right, to my community and to the people in my life. Like, I almost don't worry about what I'm going to get out of things anymore. If it's something that is worthwhile to do, right, which is, you know, teaching is always worthwhile to do, mentoring is worthwhile to do, like, I freely give that, right? Because in the back of my mind, I'm like, hey, I'm giving back. I'm doing a good thing. And who knows? Maybe I'll get something in return. Maybe not. That's not the point, right? Giving is the best way of getting back. And these lessons I've learned over the years, and they've served me well. I don't know a lot. I'm not a guru. I'm not a philosopher. But these things I know to be true.
That's a perfect way to end the podcast. I think lots of great wisdom there. Yeah, it's been a great chat. Really enjoyed chatting to you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been great fun.